Welcome to Talking New Energy, a podcast from Delta EE, the new energy experts. We'll be talking about how the energy transition is developing across Europe, with guests who are working at the leading edge of this transition. Hello, and welcome to today's episode. As the transition from old to new energy gathers pace, there are more and more opportunities, both for existing companies, new entrants and brand new companies to capture value, create better offers for customers, and to play their part in the energy transition. Today, I'm in conversation with Peter Vance, who's been actively running, growing, advising new companies in the energy space. And we'll be looking at Peter's experience of the opportunities, the challenges, and some of the lessons that he's learned. Hello, Peter.
Hi, John.
Peter, thanks for joining us. Now, to start with, can you just paint a brief picture of those last 20 years, give our listeners a feel for the different sorts of things you've been doing in this space?
Sure. So, I, as you can probably hear by my accent, I'm a Canadian by birth, a technologist by training, but a commercial guy by career. So following a PhD in physics at Oxford, which is what got me over to Europe in the first place, I've built my career in commercializing technology, specifically in the energy sector. So my passion has always been to view technology as a tool to create and enable and catalyze massive change in a number of different sectors, but my passion is around making the world a better place and accelerating the green revolution. And really, that's what I've built my career on over the last 20 or so years, mainly as the CEO running companies, sometimes an advisor of new entrant tech companies, and actually in the world of investing as well. So that's been a bit of a mix over the last 20 years.
And Peter, how much of that was deliberate? How much have you discovered your passion? How much did you know that was your passion 20 years ago?
So, I mean, I grew up, you know, next to a hydroelectric dam. Technology has always been in the blood. You know, I love walking in nature. So the idea that, you know, the environment is important has been in my blood forever. I think my deep training in technology showed me the sheer power of the modern tools that we're developing as people. And those tools are beginning to transform giant sectors around the world. So 20 years ago, I saw the first big transformations like we all have in things like the internet or telephony or communications or a number of gigantic industries being transformed by technology, but not yet the world of energy. And I think that's that was my dawning realization over the last 10 or 20 years, is that this kind of technology-enabled global revolution is well and truly, you know, underway everywhere we look, except, ironically, in one of the world's biggest industries, which is energy. And really, that's why I've built my career the way I have.
And it's interesting looking back, those of you that have been in the sector long enough will have heard of the clean tech boom and then maybe the clean tech bust. So clean tech was all the rage probably 20 years ago, Peter, but then well, is it unfair to say it became a bit of a dirty word as some investors lost their money in clean tech businesses, or expectations were too high compared to reality?
I think you're absolutely right, John. I mean, I think it was the right thought with the right vision, but its time had not yet come. So, you know, 10, 20 years ago, both the physical assets in energy, you know, those renewables technologies, those solar cells, those biofuels, call it what you want, were way too expensive, weren't proven enough, didn't have global depth in the supply chain, etc. And the digital technologies to make the whole energy system go smart weren't yet powerful enough and cheap enough and scalable enough either. And I think both those things have now changed massively in the last 10 or 20 years to make this smart green revolution now credible. You know, the costs of the physical assets in green energy have now collapsed and keep going down every year, which is fantastic. And the firepower of the digital solutions is now awesome compared to what it was 10 or 20 years ago. So really, we are standing on the shoulders of giants as far as the power of the digital transformation in other sectors. And in energy itself, the physical assets are becoming more available, more powerful, and more cost-effective.
Well, let's look at software a little bit later in the podcast, but your first venture was more in hardware. Will you tell us a bit about Ceres Power?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was hired in as employee number five or six, I forget, as the kind of hired gun CEO to kind of run the company, establish its strategic focus, you know, raise cash, build the team, get it into production, get the product to market, all of those combined risks from what was basically a material science experiment when I joined to turn it into a living, breathing business. And wow, was it an exciting journey, lots of ups and downs, the classic startup roller coaster with very high highs and very low lows. But ultimately, I am extremely proud of the legacy I left and what is now a £200 or £300 million thriving business with products being shipped across, you know, Asia and Europe. So no, I'm very proud of what I accomplished, but my goodness, it had its challenges because of the combination of new factors, new material science, new technology, new manufacturing techniques, new routes to market. You know, the combination of risks was quite eye-watering in hindsight, and hence why it was such a bumpy ride, but ultimately successful. Whereas the world of more digital solutions, which we'll touch on later, has less of those risk factors.
Well, let's come back to those risk factors, because I think that's really interesting the way you framed that. There were a lot of things that all had to go right at the same time. And is that the big learning that inevitably, well, maybe it wasn't inevitable, but in this case, they didn't all go right at the same time, and therefore one fell away. You know, the durability or lifetime of the sale or a commercial deal, you just had to take one away, and that caused big problems across the piece.
That's right. So in many ways, as every entrepreneur, but specifically in the world of clean tech, broadly defined, you're playing a game of whack-a-mole, if you know what that looks like. You know, once you've addressed one issue, another one becomes the bottleneck or the critical path, and you have to address that issue. So you get to market and your customer adoption begins, but then your operational readiness isn't quite what you thought it needed to be excellent. And then you address your operational issues, and then the market's moved on, and maybe you need to adjust your pricing, and then you adjust your pricing, and then maybe some other issue, you know, pops up. So addressing multiple parallel risks is one of the arts you need to pull off as a business leader in this emerging space. And all of this in a context which is the market itself is only becoming clearer. You know, the fog is only clearing externally. So you're trying to navigate in quite a foggy external arena as well as the internal risks that you're facing.
And I guess with hardware, the software, you can create a new algorithm in a day. Hardware, to create a new process, you might need many months to develop that, test it, look at the durability of the product that comes out. So have you lost your appetite at all for the hardware side of things? Or do you think would you go into it with your eyes wider open? Or what's your perception about innovation around hardware?
No, I haven't lost my appetite for it, but it's a specialist game that deserves specialist attention and the kind of deep pockets and committed capital. And also, I think on the critical path, which we've seen in technology areas like solar and wind, as well as now batteries, is scale, manufacturing excellence, supply chain management really, really matters. So it become, you know, the operational excellence around scale and delivery are the things that really matter in terms of both driving costs down and improving commercial viability on the market side. And really what I've chosen to do in the second big phase of my career is really focus more on the digital side of things, because I think the physical side of energy now has global momentum, in particular around renewables and energy storage. So I just don't think that I particularly have anything to add to that kind of physical energy revolution. So that's why I'm focusing more on the digital side now.
Okay. And Peter, you mentioned that fundraising, working with investors was one of your responsibilities and still is in your current role. And between the two companies, you've worked for an investment company. What have you learned about investors' willingness, desire, interest, patience to put money behind new companies, new initiatives?
Yeah, so you're right. I've been on both sides of the table. Both the business leader driving growth as CEO, but also the investor informing the allocation of capital. I spent a couple of wonderfully fruitful years, in London working with Octopus, a leading venture capital investor, but also asset-backed investor in the world of energy, and I learned a lot doing so. And you're right, capital is critical as one of those ingredients to, create big successful businesses and deliver impactful change in the market. You can't do much without cash. So it's a truism which dominates the mindshare of any decent CEO, is make sure that your business always has money in the bank. Never run out of cash. So it is by definition a focus of all CEOs, and I do pay a lot of attention to where my existing shareholders and my future investors' minds are heading. But you mustn't ever let the tail wag the dog either. So you have to be clear about what the business is in business to do, but also acknowledge the importance of delivering the kind of returns that your investors expect.
And what if you had to give advice, Peter, to someone starting up their own business, technology business in the energy sector, and who was about to go out on a roadshow looking to raise money from investors, but this person hasn't worked on the other side of the fence, what advice would you give them about the questions that investors will have, or the messages that will best land with investors?
So I guess one of my big pieces of advice for people, brave enough to go along this kind of journey, is to really test their own resilience before they start. If they're going to lose hope when they get knocked back with a no or five no's or 20 no's, then they're in the wrong game, because you have to have an amazing level of personal resilience and corporate resilience as a business leader to kind of cope with this journey, because many, many investors, good investors, simply don't want to invest in your business or even the space that you're in, not because they think it's terrible, it's just that it doesn't satisfy their investment criteria, or they're looking for returns elsewhere, or they have a different risk appetite. So even before you start, make sure that you're tooled up, ready for the journey, and recognize that it's a marathon and not a sprint. I think there's a myth out there that entrepreneurship, the tech unicorn leader, it happens overnight and you're a billionaire. That is just a myth. You need to work like crazy over years, and then if you're lucky and you do 1,000 things right, you create the next giant Google, right? But that's a lot of hard work, a lot of luck, a lot of things coming together in the right way.
Well, the analogy I like is from a book called Good to Great. I don't know if you've ever read it. And they talk about seven factors that turn good companies into great companies. And one of them is an analogy of a flywheel, that no one big push will get this huge flywheel spinning really fast. But it will need, as you say, thousands of pushes year after year to get the momentum building, to get that flywheel spinning.
I completely agree. And in fact, that's what investors are looking for. So if you're pitching your idea, in order to get the investor to buy into your vision, you need as many proof points as possible. Ideally, the proof points that are relevant for that investor with their particular risk mandate and investment appetite and amount they can invest, etc. So you need to understand them to pitch correctly, but most investors would be looking for a common set of proof points around, You know, do you understand your market? Do you have product market fit? Have you demonstrated that your solution is something that people actually want to pay for? Have you sold it at least once or twice to show that you've got something which isn't just your pet project, but is genuinely desired? Can you then deliver it? Can you deliver it repeatedly? You know, those are the kinds of questions that investors will ask you. And if any one of those is a big fat no, then you might still get the investment, but it will really be, you know, under the assumption, the pressure, the imperative to address those remaining risk factors. Otherwise, your investor base will get very worried.
Okay, turning it around, what advice would you give investors? You know, I mentioned, we talked a bit earlier about the clean tech sector, and that attracted a lot of investment. Or the clean tech boom that attracted a lot of investment at that particular time. Then the sector was out of fashion for a bit. Now I think with impact investing, there's one example, it's coming back into fashion. What advice would you give investors who are looking to get into this area?
So I think specifically into this area, because of the sheer scale of the opportunity, you know, measured in trillions, not billions, and partly because of its sheer scale, there's a certain inertia in the system, in the markets, in the companies that you're probably going to be pitching to as a startup in this space. You have to be prepared to be a patient investor, not patient, i.e. take lots of time. Patient in terms of backing your entrepreneurs to really build great solutions, take it to market professionally. Yes, be agile and get ready to adapt and pivot as necessary, but not to be deluded that this is a quick flip, get in, get out. It's all super easy. You know, this is a marathon, not a sprint. So I think that's one piece of advice I'd give. And then also another one would be, beware the entrepreneur that makes what they're doing sound like, you know, this is super simple. There's nobody else doing this at all. It's worth zillions of dollars and I'm going to deliver it, you know, in 2 weeks and it's going to be super simple. You know, the devil's almost always in the details. So testing the understanding of the market, of the product, of the financials, of the tech, you know, unless they're all over those details, they probably don't know what they're doing.
Okay. And in your recent business, Origami, which we'll come to in a sec, you're, rather than being the hired CEO, you're the founder CEO. So you've had to go out and develop your narrative, talk with investors. Can you give us, our listeners, a feel for how easy or hard it was to raise, well, how much you've raised and from how many investors or what type of investors, and how easy or hard that's been?
Yeah, so absolutely. So the quick answer is that raising money is always really hard. It is never easy.
Yeah.
Anyone who thinks raising money sounds glamorous, sounds easy, the money just rolls in by some magic, that couldn't be further from the truth. It's hard graft, it's highly uncertain, and usually fails. That's why the statistics of, you know, technology startups is actually terrible. Most of them fail, some are zombies, one or two are successful, and once in a blue moon, one is spectacularly successful. But that overall justifies getting in the ring, because the ones that do make it make an enormous impact and also enormous returns for investors. So my approach was born out of some experiences I was having between CEO gigs when I was actually working at that investment company I mentioned in London, Octopus. So this is not unusual, actually, that they and many other venture capital firms were more than happy, you know, investing in great technology businesses, usually software-based, and take venture-style risks. You know, it may or may not work, et cetera. So, but never in the energy sector, ironically. And then they're also happy to spend billions, not millions, into physical assets in another division of their company in the energy sector, things like large solar farms or gas peakers or batteries, but almost nothing in the overlap between the software startups backed by venture capital and the physical energy assets backed by debt and asset finance. You know, there's almost zero overlap between those two. And I think that's actually quite common still around the world.
I find that fascinating, Peter, because there you have in one investment company or one company, fantastic energy sector expertise and fantastic technology expertise. But as you say, virtually no overlap. Why do you think that was, or in many cases still is?
Yeah, I think the world is changing, but certainly 5 years ago when I founded Origami, that was definitely the case. And this isn't just unique to that investment company. I think all investment companies had got their brain around the software revolution was transforming most markets around the world. So the idea that you could raise venture capital to back a technology-based idea, largely based on software, to transform an industry, that was a well-established formula. But the energy world, because of its perceived risk averseness, slowness to change, huge infrastructure layers of physical, you know, copper, steel, you know, carbon fiber, you know, chemicals, etc., was seen as a really slow-moving beast, albeit a gigantic opportunity. So really,
and very regulated and very policy incentive dependent.
That's right. There was a perception that you were either making a bet on policy or a bet on infrastructure or a bet on regulation, you know, none of which are very attractive propositions for venture capitalists willing to make bets on market uptake and commercial viability of fantastic products. None of the stuff I mentioned before. But there was always an acknowledgement that the infrastructure side of energy was eventually going to suck up enormous amounts of capital with commercially viable solutions. And I think renewables have now got to that point. So as of 3 or 4 years ago, more than half of all the capital flows in terms of, you know, new energy assets are now in renewables. So that's a thing which is now an established formula. But this digital meets physical interface, certainly when I founded Origami 5 years ago, was, you know, was non-existent, and certainly non-existent in the world of the investment community, or they'd shied away from it because they tried a couple of times and got their fingers burnt. In other words, it wasn't a no-brainer formula yet. And I guess the benefit I had when I left Octopus, because I guess they got to know me as a business person, as a technologist, as an industry leader in this space, when I set up Origami, they were the lead investor, in fact. So Origami was the exception that proved the rule, and they did back a company at this interface between digital startups and physical energy infrastructure. And really, that's what Origami does, is join the physical world of energy with the digitally enabled world of, you know, markets. And and yeah, I'm pleased that on the way out they were the lead investor, and they've backed three subsequent rounds of funding along with three other big investors.
And having a lead investor like Octopus, I imagine, was really helpful in talking with other investors. You mentioned three other investors in addition to Octopus. Again, for our listeners' benefit, how many did you talk to? Tens of investors, several tens, hundreds, or actually having your experience, your track record, Octopus as a founder investor, was it... Well, I wouldn't say straightforward, but was it less challenging than it might have been in getting your other investors on board?
Yeah, it's certainly having a lead investor, no matter which round you're talking about, whether it's a seed round getting going, or the A round when you've probably got some sort of proven product, or a B round when you're starting to think about scaling. You know, it's always very, very helpful to have a lead investor who's kind of committed to invest the money. But inevitably, I think you need to think about talking to 10 times as many investors as you eventually end up with. And if you think about that kind of ratio, you won't be disappointed. So we've been through three rounds of funding as a business, raising $4 million at the seed stage when it was still essentially a concept, albeit with some early market validation, basically some letters of intent from future customers, and a fantastic advisory board I'd pulled together using my connections. And then we raised 13 million pounds in our Series A when a new investor, a family office from Scandinavia called Fred Olsen Group, joined Cambridge Innovation Capital and Octopus, who were the two investors at the seed round. And then when we raised our B round about a year ago, we raised 19 million pounds, which was led by Agreco with follow-on investment from Fred Olsen, Octopus, and CIC. That let us really start to attack the market as a credible, well-funded, professional outfit. Still totally true to our technology roots, but began to really think about operational excellence and scaling and delivery. So yeah, having four fantastic investors, all of which are quite different and complementary. One focuses more on entrepreneurship, one focuses more on deep technology, one focuses more on renewables, and one focuses more on highly distributed energy. But that complementary nature is very helpful.
Okay. Now, Peter, I know you've been itching to do so, but let's move to Origami for the last part of the discussion. So it's, as you said, a technology firm, it's digital, it's looking at optimizing distributed assets. You've been around 5 years. Can you give us, our listeners, a snapshot of Origami today?
Yeah, so you know, today we're a business based in the UK, but with customers who are part of global giant organizations. So we're focused on growing our business in the UK as a genuinely exciting commercial opportunity, but also as a proof point for what our global aspirations will ultimately deliver with the parent companies of our UK customers. So of our 70 or so employees today, about 2/3 are technologists and 1/3, you know, other, including sales and other functions. And really what we're focused on is delivering a software platform which helps our customers see what's going on, decide what to do about it, and make it happen. And what I mean by that is see what's going on externally in the markets, prices and so forth, as well as internally with their asset portfolios and their customers. Decide what to do, that's a decision engine, forecasts, optimization algorithms, a toolkit which enables intelligent decision making to deliver the returns that they're looking for. And then finally, make it happen. This is the physical and financial execution of those decisions. In other words, dispatch portfolios of assets in an intelligent way, or place financial trades or contracts in an intelligent way, and then repeat, repeat, repeat. So it becomes a, you know, almost like the operating system for a 21st century energy company is helping them see, decide, and do in real time, in a way which is increasingly automated. And that is necessary in this increasingly renewable world where the level of complexity is going up, the level of volatility is going up, the level of granularity is going up. So you need to really hit it with a technology sledgehammer to thrive in tomorrow's energy world. And those that don't adopt powerful digital solutions will wither and some will disappear, and those companies that do adopt powerful digital solutions will thrive.
Peter, we talked about your time at Ceres and the number of risks you had to manage or plates you had to keep spinning at one particular time. What would you identify as the 3, 4, 5 critical plates you have to keep spinning at Origami?
So you're right that there are still some things I focus on day in, day out, and lose sleep over at Origami, but I think those are sort of more within our gift than they were in my previous entrepreneurial venture. What I focus on today is making sure that the solution, you know, the product that we know works and know works in the UK and is able to scale is truly a global solution. So we want to make sure that the delivery we're doing with our customers in the UK is a model for exporting that solution around the world. So really that's one of the things I'm focusing on with our CTO, for example, is making sure we're architecting for global scale. I think the second thing that every decent business leader focuses on is just becoming a delivery machine, you know, having a concept arguably is pretty easy to do. Delivering on that vision and successfully maintaining the focus to deliver on that vision, that's much harder. So, you know, perspiration execution is much more important longer term than the original inspiration. And really that's what keeps me awake at night as well. And then there's the practicalities of always making sure that we're very well funded, that our shareholders share our vision and our ambition, that we can match our ambition for growth and future capital needs with future investors. There's all those kind of practicalities of fueling the business with cash, with talented people, to stay on course, not to deviate from the vision that we've set out, but to acknowledge that there are some course corrections along the way in terms of, you know, the operational delivery. You might need to pivot left and right, but with one very clear guiding direction.
How do you see your competition? Because you could view it as the cake is so big that actually there's room for enough people in the market and the challenge is growing the cake. Or you could view it as the cake is only so big and there's Origami isn't the only company with this type of business, and you're going to have to battle really hard against your competitors to get the share of the cake. So would you say it's more a battle to grow the cake or more a battle to get the slice of the cake?
At the moment, and I'd say this will be true for the next few years, it's absolutely about growing the cake, and it's horribly premature to talk about market share battles. Having said that, because the opportunity space is so enormous, there are a bunch of companies, some new entrants, but a lot of big incumbents definitely focusing on this new space because they realize it's going to be so lucrative. And if they don't get involved, they could be wiped out entirely. So there's competitive activity all over the place, but there isn't sort of a brutalist market share battle because we're only beginning to grow the pie in this kind of digital energy revolution. So the kind of companies that are active in this space are some of the legacy giants out there that have historically had energy technology hardware, and now they're trying to build energy technology software. So that's a group of competitors that we come up against, but typically we win because of our laser focus and bluntly our leadership in terms of the product and the solution. And there are also technology giants out there that have built massive software success stories around other sectors that are trying to get into the energy industry. And that's another group of would-be competitors. And then there are obviously some new entrants and some startups that, ironically, we don't compete with very often simply because we're taking a slightly different approach than most in focusing on really being a technology company as opposed to being a technology-enabled market actor, which I think is simpler and quicker to do, but ultimately less defensible and less sustainable.
And I imagine you have to keep quite a laser focus on, well, you have to respond to opportunities and be nimble, but there are lots of different directions you could get dragged in. So you have to keep quite a tight focus on where the boundaries of your activity are.
You're exactly right. We need to absolutely stick to our overall mission as a business and not deviate. On the other hand, be agile in terms of how we might need to pivot, whether it's the particular focus on the market segment or the particular feature set that the customer base needs at the moment. And also the way we deliver, the machinery internally, lends itself to this kind of agile delivery process. All of that is essential. But no, you're right. There's a common disease when you're building a business is to go after the next big shiny thing, even if that next big shiny thing is off strategy. That's the quickest way to kill a company. You're short-term smart, long-term stupid. And I think what we're trying to do is stick to our guns, do the right thing in the right way, acknowledging the rapid minor pivots are critical, but build a really coherent delivery machine which never loses its kind of true North Star. And that's what we're trying to do.
Okay. Now, we're coming towards the end of the podcast, so regular listeners will know it's crystal ball time. So, Peter, we get out our talking new energy crystal ball. Let's set the dial to 2025. Now, rather than articulate a vision for Origami in 5 years' time, because I think we've talked about that a bit already, I want you to imagine in 2025, looking back you've got a successful origami of achieving the sorts of things you've explained today. What will you look back over the last 5 years and be most proud of, or think that was a key thing or the most important thing that enabled us to get from where we were in 2019 to where we are in 2025?
I think, you know, top of the list will be the team we've built and the culture that we built within the business. You know, if we're going to be, you know, the globally leading technology platform for energy companies around the world, which is where we hope to be in 5 years' time, we can only get there with fantastically committed, talented people, with an internal, you know, agile delivery machine and a culture where everyone's committed, everyone's on the bus, and everyone's focused on doing that. So maintaining that laser focus and adapting to continuous change is, I think, the key ingredient to delivering on our aspiration as a business, which is big. You know, it's monumental. But we're not kidding ourselves. We're going to get there in one big leap.
Yeah, so you need the people with that perseverance, that belief in the mission, who get excited by that, who are going to grow with you and to keep that culture as you grow.
That's right. And also that they've probably already, you know, become quite good at some of the key things you need to do, you know, whether it's design, test and release of software into production. You know, they've done that maybe in other sectors and do it super well, or it's market facing kind of customer engagement and the delivery cycle of being excellent at delivering into demanding business customers. So B2B selling, B2B operations, you know, that's critical as well, because we're playing in a giant's world. So we need to be, you know, a blue chip provider into that world. And really that's what we need to do well as well. So it's combining the culture and the delivery machinery in line with our strategy and just being credibly but very ambitious and sticking to our guns and bringing our investors with us, which I think we are.
Great. Well, Peter, wishing you the best of success in the next 5 years and achieving those goals and aspirations. Thanks for sharing your time today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to speak to you. And if you ever want to talk again, just give me a call.
I will. So now for our listeners, that's the end of today's podcast. And that's the end of series 3. But don't worry, we'll just be taking a couple of weeks break before we're back with series 4 in the second half of November, where the first episode will be a podcast recorded at European Utility Week in Paris. So please pop by the Delta EU stand there and you can join us for that recording if you like. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back with you in a few weeks in series 4. Goodbye.